highway, on the lone highway. Hello and welcome to Operation Scorpio. Today's date is August 13, 2021. And welcome to the Free Range Open Air Insane Asylum we call Earth. Well, guys, here we are. Here we are watching the wheels come off the bus and the train derailing from the tracks. Every aspect of the controlled narrative seems to be gradually falling apart, isn't it? I mean, guys, this is really unusual. You know, it's incredible. And, you know, the narrative for the bubonic Jew jab, as Giuseppe likes to call it, who, incidentally, Giuseppe will not be here today. He is still on the road getting a new furry creature, a new dog, a new addition to the family. But he will be on board for the Sane Asylum tomorrow. And, of course, next week he'll be back for his show and back to normal. Yeah. So I just want to make sure the audio is coming good on the Speak Free Radio feed. But anyway, the narrative for the bubonic Jew jab is starting to really come apart, even on the enemy war transmissions known as the mainstream media. I mean, guys, even on Sean Hannity, who I, you know, occasionally will listen to while I'm in the car, even on the bootlicker, the Zionist bootlicker, Sean Hannity. I mean, this guy is such a slave to Israel. It's pathetic. But even on his show, he had some doctor on there that was saying in no uncertain terms that, hey, not only does this vaccine appear to be ineffective, that's a shocker, but it's actually dangerous. And obviously, you know, most of us in the independent media, I think that's a good term for it. That's the term Andy Hitchcock likes to use, the independent media. Almost all of us have been screaming this message from the rooftop since the beginning of Operation COVID Hoax. Not to say that, you know, COVID isn't real in some ways. People were certainly getting sick. But the whole narrative that we were fed about what it is, the idea that it came from a bat, purely by accident, you know, zoonotic transmission, it's absurd. And of course, the solution, the final solution of mass quaxination or the bubonic Jew jab, that's where the hoax comes in, and a deadly one at that. But we're seeing the message falling apart, you know, everywhere. And the very fact that a bootlicker like Sean Hannity would even have something on there, it's incredible. And I've heard this kind of change in the narrative on terrestrial radio in Southern California, in both San Diego and Los Angeles. So that's quite a shift, isn't it, guys, from where we were just a few months ago when it was, you know, it's safe and effective. Everyone should get it, including your child, six-month-year-old. You know, roll up his sleeve, shoot the juice in him. Don't think twice about it. Yeah, incredible. Yeah, the chickens are coming home to roost. This thing is too big. They're not going to be able to cover it all up. Malia EU in the chat room, and thanks everyone in the chat room. Always such good stuff. And we have three different chat rooms. Great stuff in all of them. Yeah, the CDC is changing the guidelines. They are. It's incredible. You don't need to socially distance anymore. You don't need to wear masks. No problem there, guys. Of course, I think part of this is just to appease the great unwashed masses until the midterm elections. I have a feeling that, you know, this fall, maybe winter, things might get spicy again on that front. But it's funny, you know, for the first time in a long time, I saw somebody wearing a face shield and a mask too in their car by themselves. Haven't seen that in a while. I still see lots of people wearing masks alone in their car. And most of them are Chinese people, but hey, I'm just an observation there. They seem to love their masks. They wear them everywhere. It's really quite incredible. But the narrative really is changing, and as controlled as the enemy war transmissions known as the mainstream media is, little bits of truth are seeping out. Only because I think everybody knows someone who was either vaccine injured or died from this incredibly dangerous experiment. Well, actually, I don't think it's an experiment. It's an intentional culling of the herd. And of course, you know, the damage has been done to some degree, hasn't it? I mean, we don't know how many people really took the shot. I think it varies quite a bit state to state, region to region. I know in California, the numbers are pretty high. Most people I encounter have taken the shot, but I meet many people who regret it. And I'll tell you guys, I know like seriously five people who died shortly after taking this shot, and you know, through friends of friends. And I've heard countless stories just from acquaintances about this. I know like five people who died within weeks or months of taking the bubonic Jew jab. It's incredible. And way more stories of people who just don't feel right after taking it and have an extreme case of vaccine regret. Not seeing too much vaccine hesitancy anymore. I'm seeing a lot of vaccine regret. But of course, there are the true believers walking around, can't wait to get another one. Oh, it's amazing. But there has to be a certain percentage of people that were either their bodies were able to handle the witch's brew of toxic chemicals that was injected into them, or there had to be a certain percentage of placebos given out just so you had, you know, some people go, well, I took it, I feel fine. What's wrong with you? Take your shot and shut up. But I really think those days are coming to an end. As I've stated many times, I'll just start talking to a complete stranger when I'm at the store or in line or anywhere. Just as a kind of an experiment to see where people are. And, you know, I enjoy talking to people just to see what happens. It's an adventure. Seeing a lot of vaccine regret. I've heard a lot of stories from people that just said, hey, I just don't feel right. A lot of weird symptoms from people that has them quite worried. And of course, the booster rollout has been disappointing, according to the controllers. It's a disappointing rollout. In other words, people are over this. They don't want to do it. And we really are seeing this sort of an unprecedented scramble to try to keep control of the narrative, aren't we? I mean, it's really amazing. It's starting to reek of desperation, isn't it? And I really do think that, you know, shows like this one and networks like Speak Free Radio are having an impact. I think the impact's bigger than we think. And of course, the other factor is just people talking, randomly talking together. That's why they wanted to get the social distancing thing going. Don't talk to one another. It's too dangerous. You know, that, and again, that's falling apart because it goes against human nature. We all need a certain degree of social interaction with our fellow men and women. Yeah, and Joey in the chat room on Twitch is saying we need to be sympathetic for the ones who gave in. I think we do to some degree. I you know, some people say, oh, screw them, let them die. Well, I don't think that's fair because, or right. Because obviously these people made a decision based on faulty information and over a year of 24/7 fear porn, you know, scientifically designed trauma. And I do think, you know, every day a new so-called normie starts to come over to our side. I don't think many people go back over and take the blue pill. You know, I really don't think that happens very much. So every day a new person comes over to our side and starts to question reality as it's presented to us. Yeah, we are ruled by deception. And that rabbit hole goes pretty deep. We've been lied to about almost everything. And when you get to some of the more advanced information, it starts to sound so crazy and insane and weird. But I think it's important to reach people at the level that they're able to understand at the moment. You know, you can't just walk up to someone and say, hey, you know, the Jews are running things and they're trying to kill as many people as they can right now. You kind of have to baby step people towards things, I believe. You've got to reach people at the level they're able to comprehend it at. Yeah. I almost started to sound like Tex Mars there for a second because nobody could say the Jews like Tex Mars. He was quite a trailblazer in his day, for sure. I remember listening to cassette tapes of Tex back in the 90s, back when cassette tapes, I don't even know if cassette tapes still exist. Probably not. I don't know. That was a long time ago, but a lot of trailblazers, and Tex was one of them for sure. And as we see this desperation emanating from the powers that should not be, the synagogue of Satan, we're seeing this desperation become palpable. And I'm sure by now people have heard of the UNESCO warning about conspiracy theories. And, you know, Giuseppe and I did a show with Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, and I believe he posted it for the Friday show talking about this, and it was really excellent. Andy really kind of brought together some great information, and we sort of chimed in and helped out. So go on the archives over there on Speak Free Radio and check that out. I really like Andy. He's the more I get to know him, the more I just really respect the guy and appreciate his perspective and his character. And that's been one of the greatest gifts for me personally doing this show, is meeting some really, really incredible people. But, you know, the UNESCO warning, you know, this like, there's dangerous conspiracies floating around the internet. It's very dangerous. Don't listen to them. Don't share them. Don't click on them. It's all too dangerous. Trust the experts. You know, it's actually kind of funny on a certain level. And it almost seems like a Babylon Bee parody, like so many clown world stories we're seeing. But one thing that was really interesting about the UNESCO warning, and when you see big groups like the United Nations, UNESCO, trying to warn people, don't think about conspiracy theories, please listen to our version of reality. Because that's, if you think about it, all a conspiracy theory really is trying to explain the world, the way the world actually works, the way power works, instead of the childish, fairy tale, grade school version of the world they try to present to the great unwashed masses. And one of the most interesting things from this UNESCO warning that I found really interesting was they were saying that conspiracy theories can lead to violence and terrorist acts. And I was thinking about this, guys, and you know what? I have to agree with that. Yes, I have to agree that conspiracy theories can lead to violence and terrorist acts. Oh, yes. Let's look at what happened after 9/11. The government, with its ally, the enemy war transmissions known as the mainstream media, churned out an outlandish conspiracy theory. Absolutely outlandish that a bunch of primitive goat herders living in a cave in Afghanistan managed to outsmart the US military, all of the intelligence agencies around the world, and the entire military industrial complex. They were all outsmarted by some goat herders living in a cave. And as the result, two planes brought down three buildings. That's one hell of a conspiracy theory, guys. And as the result of this very dangerous conspiracy theory, a government-sanctioned conspiracy theory, as a result of this government-sanctioned conspiracy theory, two wars were launched, resulting in a lot of violence and a lot of terrorism. A war in Afghanistan and a war in Iraq. Even though, according to their own conspiracy theory, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, but hey, never mind that. And really, we saw literally millions of people killed, maimed, terrorized for a period of over 20 years. So, yes, conspiracy theories can lead to violence and terrorism, especially those that are deliberately cooked up by intelligence operatives and government psychologists to deceive the public and get them whipped into a frenzy, whipped into a frenzy of bloodlust and war. Yeah. But of course, we're not supposed to think about, government-sanctioned conspiracy theories. That's not the problem, no matter how outlandish it may be. And I don't think you can top that one in terms of death, violence, maiming, and terrorism. So any warning about a non-sanctioned conspiracy theory is going to, pale in comparison. There's no way to compare it. And of course, the real reason is they don't want non-sanctioned conspiracy theories running around. What amounts to it's forbidden information that they don't want the unwashed masses to know about. Those are the dangerous conspiracy theories. Incredible, but it is interesting to see this absolute desperation to try to control the narrative It's palpable. And I think it's really a new development. I don't think we've seen this level of desperation. And honestly, I think as bad as the bubonic Jew jab has been and COVID, I think it's actually opened up a lot of people's minds to seeing that something ain't right with reality as it's being presented to us. And speaking of conspiracy theories, you know, the show trial of Alex Jones, the master conspiracy theorist, which really he's sort of a consolidation and a corporatization of conspiracy theories all into one man, a man who I believe has been controlled and guided through his career since the beginning. We're seeing this show trial, and show trial is really a good word for it because there's a lot of evidence to suggest this isn't even a real trial. It's a lot of anomalies about this trial that do not make sense. I mean, maybe it was, you know, real in the sense that it's on the books, but so many things about this are just completely screwy. And of course, let's not forget that, you know, Jones admitted that he was an actor. He admitted he's an actor during his divorce trial and child custody trial. But anyway, so many anomalies here that don't add up. I mean, who, you know, in their own defense would say that they intentionally lied about Sandy Hook? You could say, hey, I was mistaken. I thought it was a hoax, but it turns out it was all real. He says, no, I intentionally lied about Sandy Hook. I intentionally lied. You know, basically trying to throw himself at the mercy of the court, maybe. I don't know, but that's not a very good defense. And it's possible, you know, that Jones is an unknowing operative. You know, I don't think they sit people down and say, okay, Alex, come here. You're going to join the Illuminati now. And, well, basically, we run the world. And here's the way we're doing it. And here's the secret history of the human race. You know, I don't think they sit people down and give them a talk like that. Maybe at a higher level, people do get that talk, but I think it's important to remember all of this stuff is run on a need to know basis. So each player on the stage has the absolute minimum amount of knowledge they need to play their role. Because that way you can manipulate their actions from above. And I think the Freemason model of 33 degrees, you know, each level has a greater knowledge sphere than the level below. I think that's a good model of understanding how these things operate. But one of the things that really stuck out with me in this show trial is the idea that Alex Jones' lawyers accidentally emailed a whole cache of, you know, private emails to the other side's attorney. And magically, the other side is able to use all this information. Well, you know, of course, in the legal system that used to exist, that would not be admissible anywhere. Of course, but not in this trial. No, they're able to use all of it. In fact, what's interesting is they forwarded all the emails to the January 6th committee, another very dubious, you know, organization. Another show. They emailed, you know, all those emails to the January 6th committee. So now they're going to use that information, that intimate information, to further their conspiracy theory and to sort of merge the two psyops into one, to dovetail them together, right? It's all one grand conspiracy. And of course, this leads us into Donald Trump and another actor. This leads us into Donald Trump and the great document heist. It's really amazing to see the bifurcation of reality by the enemy war transmissions known as the mainstream media. Yes, the bifurcation of reality, because, you know, the liberals are saying, you know, for lack of a better term, the left wing, whatever you want to call it, media is saying, this is very serious. Donald Trump took classified documents that you have to go into a special room to read. And this may have included a nuclear secrets. So this is very, very serious, guys. We can't have, you know, a state secrets just watching around willy-nilly. This is very serious. This guy's violated many laws. No other president has ever done that. This is very serious. And then you flip over to a so-called conservative channel. And I just do it on the internet. I don't have television. And they say, this is terrible. This is a, oh, I almost went into an Alex Jones voice. This is terrible. This is like a Banana Republic kind of a situation here. But it is. It really is, you know, where you have the new administration putting charges against the old administration and essentially trying to get them thrown into jail so they, you know, neutralize the opposition. And that's exactly actually what happened in Ecuador, you know, that they when this Correa guy, President Correa, left office, the new presidente essentially leveled charges against him and he had to flee the country or face charges for embezzlement and a whole bunch of stuff, which a lot of it was probably true, but you see the pattern here. So it's just interesting to see, you know, the obvious comparisons between this and how a third world country works. But we have this bifurcation of reality where, you know, the two sides are just fed a completely different vision of what's going on. And I think this is an integral part of Trump, bringing Trump onto the scene, was this great splitting of everything politically in the country. And that process continues today. And, you know, it's amazing. There's so many people that are enamored with Trump. And what I've found is that those people are actually most, for the most part, pretty intelligent people and well-intentioned people. And, you know, I was just talking to a lady this morning at an appointment before the show. And, you know, this lady was really nice and she gets the whole vaccine thing. She gets the masking BS, tired of it, not going to play along, won't take the shot, but thinks Trump is, you know, the great answer to the problems. And so many of these people are, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places, as the song goes. And it's just interesting to see the caliber of people that have kind of fallen into the Trump hole, the rabbit hole of Trump. And that's the whole purpose of all of this, is to put all opposition to Groper Joe and essentially the neo-communist, Bolshevik, Zionist, you know, reality that's unfolding, and putting all that opposition into the Trump basket, a basket of deplorables, right? As Hillary Clinton said, put them all in that basket and then delegitimize all of it with, you know, this idea that there was an insurrection. We had an insurrection, guys, which is such a misuse of the word, isn't it? It's more like a self-guided tour of the Capitol. Yeah. And I think, you know, LTC Roll is making a good point too. Just, you know, I think it's also just to draw people back into the political process. You know, like, you know, the president's important. He's not just a salesman. He's not a puppet on a string. you know, the president is the pinnacle of power in the United States. It's hard to say that without laughing because it's so easily disprovable. And one of the things, like this lady was saying this morning, you know, Trump tells it like it is. And to some degree, that's true. He spoke very bluntly and in a different way to the public than has been done, but very short on action. And then, of course, he surrounds himself with swamp creatures of the highest order, like John Bolton. You know, so great on talk, short on actions. And it's pretty easy to prove that Trump is a compromised individual on many levels. And it's interesting, of course, you know, this Merrick Garland character is the attorney general. And, you know, it's been kind of floating around the internet for a while that his real name is Garfinkel, Moishe Garfinkel. And, you know, I just wanted to sort of check on that to make sure it's really true, because I've sort of, you know, repeated that, but I wanted to make sure it's true. And it, sure enough, it actually is true. His real name, his family name is Garfinkel. And it's funny when, you know, I was kind of looking back on when this character first came onto the scene. And of course it was during the last days of the Obama administration. And they tried to actually, you know, present him as some kind of Protestant in the very beginning, which is pretty funny if you look at the guy's face, but anyway, but his name really is Garfinkel. And, you know, I checked some sources here, and there's a sort of an online magazine called The Tablet, which is Jewish. It's one of these Jewish, you know, publications like The Forward, which it's good to read that stuff, because when they think they're talking amongst themselves, they're much more blunt and honest about things, where they'll say things like, hey, yeah, we run Hollywood, so what? Of course we do. But yeah, in the Tablet magazine, and of course, everyone writing for this publication is Jewish. Not a whole lot of diversity going on there, guys. That's all a one-way street, isn't it? But yeah, it's everyone, you know, every name associated with that magazine, The Tablet, is Jewish. All the writers are Jewish, every one of them. But anyway, in this magazine, they state, yeah, you know, his great-grandfather's name was Lieb Yitzhak Garfinkel. And that, you know, they changed their name, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that is the real name, Garfinkel, not Garland. And it's amazing they were trying to pass him off as some kind of Protestant when he first came on the scene. So yeah, he's the orchestrator, Moishe Garfinkel, aka Merrick Garland, signed the warrant to get those very important documents back in the National Archives, even though it turns out pretty much every president has taken, you know, personal mementos and documents when they left. Amazing. I guess Obama took 30,000 documents when he left. Yeah, he's a trans Protestant. Yeah, he's a transitioning. Yeah. So that's interesting. It's confirmed, Garfinkel. Good to check on things like that, and nothing like a Jewish source to proudly proclaim the truth. And then, you know, they're trying to further this idea, right? We've got Trump. He's the bad guy. But then what they're doing is they're creating a hero. You've got this bifurcation again, right? You've got the great hero, Trump. He's going to ride in on a white horse and save the day. Then on the other hand, you've got, he's a traitor. He might have sold nuclear secrets to the Russians. Who knows? even though, you know, it's pretty common knowledge, they change the nuclear codes like all the time. So the idea that those are relevant or anything more than a memento is laughable. But the idea that the FBI is going to go into, you know, the former president's house and search, it sends a message to all of us too, doesn't it? Yeah. And then, of course, now we've got some guy went to the FBI office in Ohio with a nail gun and an AR-15 rifle. And apparently this guy shot the nail gun a few times at a glass plate window, waved the AR-15 around, and there's some kind of standoff. And of course, according to our evidence, he was at the January 6th insurrection. Again, the continuation of this story of this conspiracy theory, right? And then he runs into a cornfield. He ran into the field of dreams, the cornfield, and the FBI had no choice but to shoot him. But of course, they have him, a picture of him there at the outside the Capitol building at the insurrection on January 6th. So the continuation of this narrative that there's this grand plot of white supremacists and other bad guys just waiting to destroy our democracy. So yeah, lots of FBI stuff going on in the news. And then we've got what the FBI arrested some guy, an Iranian operative that was trying to have John Bolton assassinated. Which, you know, I can't say that's not such a bad idea. I don't condone that. But, you know, if you had to pick someone that might be worthy of that, John Bolton would be a good possibility. John Bolton is such a war hawk and a chicken hawk. He didn't go to Vietnam. Oh, no, he got deferred. Let's you and them fight. But of course, the FBI, you know, stopped the evil plot by the Iranians, the boogeymen, the Iranians. And of course, this guy was talking to an FBI informant, as usual. That's really about all the FBI does, is set people up in sting operations. Yes, if you shoot, they will come. Exactly. Yeah, so again, another dubious sting operation where they're setting someone up, a bad guy. We stopped them. Those Iranians are wanting to kill Americans now. Clown world at its finest. Clown world at its finest. And, you know, speaking of clown world, it's really incredible this what Inflation Reduction Act, which should be called the Clown World Manifestation Act. If there was ever anything that sort of epitomizes the clown world, is the idea that you're going to reduce inflation through government spending and deficit spending. It's really the most absurd thing you can imagine. And one thing, I guess, I don't want to go into details about this ridiculous bill, but the important part to me is they're beginning to manifest this new Green Deal, you know, sort of piecemeal. But there's like $300 or $400 billion of you know, green energy spending here. And that's just the beginning, of course. And part of the bill here is this carbon capture technology, which this is, you know, clown world science. It's science. Clown world science at its best, at its finest. you know, it's these machines that cost billions of dollars that scrub carbon out of the atmosphere, and then they're going to, you know, put the carbon underground, or, you know, put it in some pit underground or something like this. And that somehow this will have any impact on the atmosphere other than perhaps in the surrounding area, you know, that it might have an impact close by. But, you know, the size of the world is so large that you'd have to have millions and millions of these machines everywhere all around the world to even have a modicum of impact. I mean, it's really beyond absurd. And, yeah, and of course, these machines are going to have to be run with electricity that comes from a power plant. Just like the wonderful electric cars, that's the other part of this bill, is they're going to start putting up electric car charging stations. And the amount of juice that these things are going to have is staggering. Absolutely staggering. They said on NPR that 350 megawatts is the current that's going to be in these charging stations. That's like an apartment building total. Then you still have to wait around for an hour to charge up your car. So you can see on so many levels, this green technology is designed to fail. It's not going to work, but it will decrease people's ability to travel freely. And that's the whole point. That's the whole point. And, you know, I'm always amazed that, you know, there's lots of these wind farms in Southern California. I've driven by them countless times, and I have to say, most of the time, they're not spinning, producing zero electricity. And at the same time, when they do spin, it's a bird holocaust going on there, for real. And the other thing I see that's really strange is you'll see a whole row of them all lined up together. None of them are spinning but one. So obviously, that one is being fed electricity somehow to make it spin. And of course, you know, that's not going to work out so well. And pretty soon, they're going to make it clear that the only way this works, or it'll be clear to many people, the only way any of this works is if we have a greatly reduced population. It's the only way it works, guys. You're not going to power major cities with solar panels and windmills. And the sad part is, I do believe there's technology out there that would blow people away and completely change the paradigm. I mean, Tesla is just one example. The things he was working on 100 years ago are still kept from the world. Just amazing. Another thing that really caught my eye here as we come to the close of the hour, and by the way, we're going to have a really interesting guest come up at the top of the second hour. It's a guy from Washington, D.C. area, Io, and he wrote a book called Jews Are the Problem. And he's an interesting character, so, and a different kind of guest for this show. So we'll see where this goes. It ought to be really interesting. But the other thing that caught my eye, guys, that I found important, is that we're seeing the chess pieces being moved around for a potential future world war. And I think that's on the table. I think, you know, the plans are very fluid right now, and war has always been the sort of the go-to event to change civilizations very rapidly. Because as, you know, Operation COVID hoax sort of crashes and burns, they're going to need something new. And of course, this new Green Deal is going to be a big part of it. You're going to see calls for a climate emergency, et cetera, coming soon. Because really, if you just distill it down, it all amounts to controlling energy production and natural resources of the planet. It's beyond ideology. It's raw control of natural resources, raw power. But we're seeing the chess pieces sort of moved around for a potential world war at the same time as another sort of possibility, I believe, for transformation. And, you know, I was monitoring some of the sort of left-leaning, very left-leaning propaganda in the mainstream media. But this didn't get a lot of press. But the top Chinese diplomat, Xing Shaofeng, whatever, I don't know what his name is, but, you know, the top Chinese diplomat to America, he said, America is the instigator and initiator of the war in Ukraine. And that America wants to exhaust and crush Russia with a protracted war and the cudgel of sanctions. And that's a quote of what the guy said. And, you know, that's, you can't really disagree with that. There's a lot of truth to that. I hate to come across like I'm agreeing with the Chinese, but that is a position that certainly has some backing and some evidence to support it. You know, most notably that NATO has been expanding eastward since the fall of the Soviet Union after promising to never move one inch to the east. That's what George H.W. Bush promised. And that's just the beginning of the troubles that were stirred up in Ukraine by the international elf, Victoria Nuland, her husband, the PNAC guy, Robert Kagan, from the Kaganovich family that has its roots in Bolshevik Russia. So there's truth in what was said, but what's important is the Chinese are backing the Russians in this. And I'm seeing even on the left a sort of a less enthusiastic support for Ukraine. You know, it wasn't long ago, all these idiots, I stand with Ukraine. Zelensky's a modern day hero. He's wonderful. He's fighting for democracy. But, you know, slowly information is leaking out even to the left that, by the way, he shut down all the media platforms and consolidated everything into one state-run media platform. He shut down the rest, and he's arrested a bunch of his political opponents. And it's another little thing that came out from the left that isn't getting a lot of press, again, is that Amnesty International, you know, which is hardly something I would, you know, call the word of God or anything like that, but they, even Amnesty International, came out and said that Ukraine has been using schools, hospitals, and apartment buildings to stage military activities. And of course, that's what the Russians have been claiming since the beginning. So again, the narrative is falling apart because the truth always wants to come out. And not everyone that's a player on the stage wants to see, you know, a dystopia manifest in our reality. Yeah. We're fighting for democracy, guys. We're trying to save democracy in Ukraine. It's so absurd. And of course, the other interesting thing that happened in Ukraine recently is While Ukraine faces an existential threat of Russia destroying its country and its sovereignty and its borders, at the very moment that's supposedly going on, the Zelensky character is moving to try to legalize gay marriage. You know, like, that really makes a lot of sense. If your country is under attack and you're facing the destruction of your country, what's the first thing you do? Well, let's legalize gay marriage. Very, very important. That'll change things. That'll make it better. But what I see as important in this, though, is that the agenda items roll on throughout all the you know, the chaos and the problems that we're supposed to believe are all real. The agenda moves on. And what's interesting, guys, is that it's actually in the Ukrainian constitution that marriage is between a man and a woman. So they're going to have to change the constitution to get this thing going in the middle of an existential war. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Okay, well, we're already at the top of the hour, guys. And everyone stay tuned for the next hour. It's going to be interesting and a little spicy. Okay, welcome back to hour number two of Operation Scorpio. And today, we're going to welcome a special guest, an author, Io, author of the book, Jews Are the Problem. Quite a provocative title, gets right down to the point. Io, how are you, sir?
Fantastic. How about yourself?
Doing good. I'd like to thank you for coming on the show. Dave Gaheri speaks very highly of you, and I really can appreciate anyone that writes a book, especially one with the title that you have on your book. That gets right to the point, and I think it shows a good deal of courage and perception. So let me ask you to start with, Io, you know, how did you get on this path of knowledge? I think that's always a good starting point. What brought you into this sphere of information, and what was your journey to get there?
Quite a journey. originally, first of all, thank you for being on the program. Dave definitely spoke highly of you guys as well. To be quite frank, I'm just so you know, I'm a very honest person. So I'm going to just tell the truth, however it feels. You know, I just had to deal with that ramification. That's been what I'm known for.
Good.
I started all of this because I was dealing with racism. As a young person, my mother taught me, you know, have pride in yourself, blah, blah, blah. But also, hey, here's the reality. This is what you're going to deal with coming up. So I only understood white and black. I never knew that anything that I was dealing with related to racism or racial aggression, I never knew when I was young, it had anything to do with Jew or Anglo-Saxon. I didn't even know how to identify such a thing. There's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Tony Martin. And Dr. Tony Martin in the 80s, a book was written, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews by the Nation of Islam.
Yes.
And at the time, quite frankly, because I was only black and white, I it's almost like you hear the word Jew and you don't even know if you want to go into this other realm of trying to understand something. So I wasn't even interested in the book per se. But when Tony Martin wrote his book, The Jewish Onslaught, because he was a professor at a university. I forget the name of it. It'll come to me. It's a prominent. It's not Wellesley College. He was a professor. Hey, we got a new book, Secret Relationships. It's a history book. Let's do it in our school. When he did it, the assault he received from the Jews was incredible. Just for saying, hey, we're going to read the book and review it. And so, you know, they were dealing with a brother from the islands. Brother from the islands, if you don't know anything about people from the islands, they got a temperament. So he fought back. And fought back and started studying them and started realizing a lot of our greats like Marcus Mosiah Garvey, Elijah Muhammad, these people who were ultra black, actually had much more in common and were working with white nationalists and were saying, quite frankly, what the title of the book says, the Jews are the problem. Between black and white, we can sit down at a table and agree where we can disagree. But it doesn't work that way with the Jew. He doesn't allow for that to happen, because if that ever happened properly, both parties would see who the problem is. And so I was in an organization. It's a very militant black organization. And the brother who was the leader, very, very, very bright, very, very brilliant man. He read the Jews are the he read the Jewish Onslaught. And he told us, every black man, all brothers, we have to read this book. And I didn't want to read the book, but, you know, I followed instructions well. And after I read that book, an entirely new world opened up to me. And after that, I started going to read Henry Ford. Since that time, I've actually started looking at people like Andrew Harrington Hitchcock. You know, I've read a lot of different resources. Hitchcock is one of my favorite, man. I mean, he really gets to the point. A lot of things you don't know. The Nation of Islam, of course, did three books on your relationship between blacks and Jews, part 1, 2, and 3. Each one of them focuses on a different period. And what I found in doing this, as I was trying to deal with really protecting black interests. Even if you think that you're doing something, and you may be doing something that's very valuable in white-black relations, if you do not understand the Jewish aspect of it, you really ultimately are missing the key point.
Absolutely. And if I could just jump in here for a second, you're making some great points, Io. And, you know, it's interesting that back in the 60s, Lincoln Rockwell, you know, this sort of eccentric character, white nationalist type, actually had quite a bit of interaction with the Nation of Islam and had very amicable relations with them, which is interesting. And then, you know, these books, The Secret Relation Between Blacks and Jews, is really interesting. We should go into this, but one thing that's really important that the listeners need to understand is that those books did not use any so-called anti-Semitic sources. They only used Jewish historians as in the footnotes. So that's where all the information came from Jewish historians, not from, you know, right-wing crazy white supremacists or anything like that. So very interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you something that's interesting since you bring that point up. And it's something that, at least for me, I've implored and it's been beneficial to me. I've learned something about Jews and how they operate. If you try to play defense, they're going to destroy you. If you back up an inch, they're going to knock you out. I never apologize for anything I say to them or how I say it. I don't deflect from their accusations. They can call me what they want. I'm gonna call them something too. So we'll be calling each other something. But what I've noticed is that they never address the issues on the table. They rely on people's goodwill and hearts of not wanting to be viewed in a certain manner as the fuel to back the people up. From particularly when you're landing right over the target, the closer you get to landing and hitting the target where you're identifying the horrid behavior that they're involved in and you're calling out directly and you're saying who's doing it and why. When you look them in the face and say you're the problem, that's why I wrote the book this way. They don't dispute you because they can't. They begin to call you names. They begin to get vile. They begin to make accusations. And what I've learned is that the people that fight them the best are straight ahead fighters. At least that's been my experience. I've learned trying to duck them and dodge them and outwit them and outsmart them. And, you know, that's cool, but you're not going to get but so far. The hard, direct ones that say, you're the problem. This is what you're doing. We got to stop you from doing it. And then make them answer a question. To put them on defense and keep them on the defense, I think that's the best way to fight them.
Yeah, and I think the tactic also is to, like you said, call names and call you a racist, call you a denier. You know, now we have climate deniers and Holocaust deniers and election deniers, despite the fact that there's so much evidence to the contrary of all of those things that can be easily presented. But it's this, then you're, of course, the ultimate is you're an anti-Semite, you know. And these are just designed to extinguish free speech and to put the fear of God into people so they don't speak their mind. And I think that had a lot to do with this idea that, well, we had to socially distance. Don't come close to each other. They don't want people talking as they try to reconfigure our entire civilization and complete their takeover of the West and the world in general.
See, what you're doing now is you're talking the practical reality that those of us that can see what they're doing, it's really what's happening. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have the eyes to see. And what I wanted to do with this book, I wrote this book in this kind of way. When you're reading the book, for a person that knows, you're going to love it because you're still going to get some carrots that you didn't have before. But for the person who doesn't know anything about Jews, it removes any of that. It's written in a very simplistic manner, and it has a lot of QR codes. So, for instance, let's say this interview went extremely well and there were some things that were easily verifiable about the things that are happening that a person, any person looking at will believe. We put those QR codes in there so that people, they're so into technology now, they can click right on it and it'll take them to something that they can see. Because what I've learned is that the reason that most people are resistant to wanting to hear about the evil that the Jews are doing is because it's unbelievable to them and they don't know anything about it. It's new information. It's a new idea, and they don't even want to get involved with it. And it's been scandalized so much, like you said, with words like anti-Semitic and things of that nature. But the truth of it is, when we look at the entire history of this country, the most severe racial animosity, violence, murder, and destruction have been grafted and crafted by the Jews. The issues that we're facing right here today, whether it's on the verge of food crisis, whether it's these, we call it the gateway to the apocalypse in terms of these injections. I mean, we're talking about an open genocide war where they're asking people to commit suicide. It's one thing before any of us knew what was really going on. I can frankly say when this thing first happened and they said there's a disease going around and people are getting sick, I said, here we go with this H1N1 thing again. I'm not going for this. And when people started dying, even myself, I was like, whoa, what's going on? We didn't know. That's in 2020. It's 2022. We have data now. VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. That's not speculative. It's a data system with the reported numbers of deaths and adverse effects from these injections. These are the most dangerous. This is by their statistics, which are highly underrated. Like, they're not counting nearly as many deaths and adverse effects as we gonna as that are actually happening. But what they are reporting now up to about 30,000 deaths. If you add up all of the the vaccines from 1990, when the VAERS system was created, used by the CDC to talk about how vaccines are the damage that they're doing to people. People can report. If you add up every vaccine over 31 years, in 1 year, these three vaccines, they're not vaccines, these three injections, Pfizer, Moderna, and Janssen, those three have more deaths reported in 1 year than all vaccines. That includes the flu shots. We're talking about billions of shots, maybe more than hundreds of billions over the course of 31 years. These are the most dangerous thing that's posing as medicine in the history of the United States of America.
Oh, yeah. No question. No question. Yeah, you know, it's great to talk to someone that sees that so clearly. And, you know, maybe you could kind of talk about things from this perspective a little bit. Obviously, you look at the history of vaccines, and they've used Black people as the, you know, the experimental guinea pigs on some of these things in the past. That's documentable. And I think like in your community, the people, you know, how many people around you see the vaccine, or, you know, we call it the bubonic Jew jab, see it as an intentional, or at least at the very least an experimental, you know, witch's brew to that may not be such a good idea. I mean, what's been the response? Because I guess they've been saying, well, a lot of people of color are vaccine hesitant. We have to change this. So, you know, I wonder why. But what's your thoughts on that, or your observations?
Our observation is this. This is what I find from most communities. Most people say, you guys are lucky as Black people because you all don't want to take that jab. from our vantage point, for those of us that know what's going on, when we look out, we say, you guys are lucky as white folks. Your people don't want to take these jabs. What's happening is those of us that see, we can see. Well, we're looking right. for people that are resisting. What's happening is we're finding resistance wherever it is. The truth of it is the bulk of all of our people, because of the Jewish control of mainstream media and censorship, most of our people don't know what's going on. Now, I will say Black people have a more natural hesitance because we have a history of this kind of thing. So that natural hesitance, it is there. I can attest to that. But I can also say the absolute blindness and repugnant, for lack of a better term, dumbness, not dumb like meaning you can't read a book and learn something and you know put it back, but dumbness in terms of this is something I talk about. And I think sometimes we got to slow down, because once we get this information, we know things, we move so fast. When we slow it down, it's much uglier than it looks even on the surface. Think about it for a minute. Most of us, we all heard this and it stopped all of us for a moment. But then after we stopped, we never really considered ourselves to ask the question why they did this. Do you remember when they first came out with these jabs, when they said you were actually jabbed? When were you actually, quote unquote, jabbed, vaccinated? We know they're not vaccinations, but when you got the harmful injection, when were you actually jabbed? Do you remember what they said?
No.
It wasn't the day you got it. When were you actually jabbed, though? You don't remember?
No.
It was 14 days.
Oh, right. Day? Yes. Yes.
You remember that? Here's my question. Why do you think they said 14 days?
Mm-hmm.
I'm asking you. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm asking you. Why do you think that they made it 14 days?
Well, I think the official story is that that's how long it takes for the reaction inside your body to kick in. That's their story. I don't believe anything about this bubonic two jab.
Right.
Yeah, what's your explanation?
We call them the Jew shots. You call them the Jew jab. Same thing. when we're doing it publicly, we say harmful injections because everybody's not ready for the Jew shot.
Right.
It's the Jew shot, the Jew jab. Right. So this is why they did it. And it's very disturbing because all of us know it. We all knew it was something wrong. Here's what's happening. If you remember, we just talked about the VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System.
Mm-hmm.
What they did was they, in front of our face, they gave themselves permission to not count anybody in the first 14 days that dies or gets harmed. Think about it. If you and I, 1,000 of us go into a room and 1,000 of us get the Jew shot, and tomorrow 1,000 of us are dead, we say 1,000 of us died from the Jew shot. But from them saying you only got the vaccination 14 days after the shot, they have the opportunity now to say, well, even though all 1,000 of them died, it hadn't been 14 days. So you didn't die from the vaccine. You haven't technically been vaccinated. So now, if the bulk of the people who die in the first 14 days, none of them have to be counted. Which means the numbers that we are even getting in VAERS are, even though it only counts roughly 1% of the actual damage that it does. So that means for if it's 30,000, that would be 3 million. But that doesn't account for the fact, based on what they told us, because we went for it. Oh, 14 days, you haven't been jabbed yet, even though you were jabbed. They don't even have to count anybody who passes or anything that happens in the first 14 days.
That is a great point, Io. That's a very good point. Yeah. Because some people die immediately they literally drop dead right after taking the shot. And I actually know a couple of different people that became extremely ill within days of taking the shot, ended up in the hospital and died like a week later. So that's a really good point. I hadn't actually thought of that, but yeah, so it's just, they've massaged the numbers in every way on this thing. It's the biggest lie we've ever seen. And it's going to go down in history as the biggest medical experiment and debacle in modern history. There's no question about it. You know, what I find interesting too is, you know, the Jews have used, I mean, in their own writing, they actually talk about using black people to further their goals. They're very open about this. If you actually read their own material, and you know, for example, going back to the secret relationship between blacks and Jews, there was an additional smaller book that came out that's just a reprint of ads of, you know, Moishe Israel is selling 5 slaves this Friday, you know, at 3. And, you know, you've probably seen that too. It's just a reprint of all of these ads from the newspapers of the time, which is really interesting to actually read. Oh my God. I mean, that's an actual ad, a reprint from the day, you know? And, they even, you know, if you look at some of the Jewish writings from the 20s after the Bolshevik Revolution, they really made an effort to go into black communities and try to recruit black people into, you know, communism, because they thought that they could manipulate them into their cause. So maybe you could comment on this sort of, that's another tangent of this secret relationship between blacks and Jews. Maybe you could go into that more, because it's amazing how they use every racial group as a pawn on the chessboard, you know.
We call it proxy. It's like you say pawn. Everybody is a proxy, a pawn for the Jew. They don't really care who you are. In their worldview, it's the Jews against the rest of you. And anybody that's working with the Jews is still just a pawn of the Jews. They're working with the Jews, but they will be discarded any moment. Let's take just a brief historical analysis. I'm not going to go through each part, but just to show just the Jewish assault on black people in particular, and how in this case, and then I'll get to your point about what they were doing with black people in the 20s. But let's go back to the early 1800s and just show how they use black whites against black people. And then, you know, they flip it whenever they want to flip it. So we just kind of show how it works. So,
right.
In the early 1800s, in 1831, there was a man named Nat Turner, and he had a slave rebellion, and his slave rebellion was following what happened in Haiti as the Haitians freed themselves from the French and became an independent nation. Black people in America got the word and said, we want to be free too. And the Haitians were actually working to try to make that happen. Long story short, what people don't know is that from a cultural perspective, yes, all whites in the South participated in slavery. They were involved in some way. That was the way of the world at that time. But to be honest about it, from a business perspective, talking money and finance, most whites didn't own slaves.
Yeah.
They participated in the process. Maybe they were a slave driver. Maybe they transported. So, you know, they did something related to the system, but they weren't the ones making the money off cotton, off sugar, and off the slave routes, off ensuring enslavement. That was the Jews.
Yeah.
So it was the Jews who did not want slavery to end, but they were on both ends. They always, if you don't know that about them, if Henry Ford didn't teach you anything else, which he taught us a lot, if you don't understand that they're on both sides of the equation, you're going to always lose, because they'll confuse you. On the one hand, when we talk about the South, they were strong slave advocates. Some of the most virile racists of that time were Jewish, because they had the largest slave plantations. So once the rebellions in America happened and the black people started saying, we want to end slavery. And there were some whites who said, you know what, it's time for that to end too. Because they started realizing how much power the South had. It's just most people don't ever say. A lot of times people think when they say the power that the whites in the South had, they think those were white Anglo-Saxons. There were a few of them that were rich and powerful. It was mostly Jewish money we're talking about. These were Jews that had the power. Yeah. And so what happened is they didn't like the fact that there were spokespersons among black people who were reaching out talking about abolition. So most people don't know this. They created what we now classify as the entertainment industry strictly as an effort to keep black people enslaved. It started with something they call blackface characters. A Jew, Thomas Dartmouth Rice, started painting himself black, going around.
Al Jolson.
That's right. Went into vaudeville and it ends up with Al Jolson and all. But we're talking about from the 1830s now. We know about it up in the 1900s, but the birth of what we call entertainment, the entire what we talk and classify as Hollywood, television, radio, the birth of it in this country was from Jews trying to tell whites, many of whom in the North didn't have slaves. So it didn't mean the same thing to them. Many of them weren't dealing with black people, so they didn't really know what to think about black people. Their idea of the Jews to say black people want to remain enslaved and they deserve to remain enslaved. So let's depict them as people who should remain enslaved. And that became the major pastime of this country up until the 1930s. Blackface was America. Shirley Temple, Al Jolson. You just have any number of them with the blackface characters. When we get into the Civil War, a lot of times, again, people don't understand. Who was the second in command of the Confederacy? Judah P. Benjamin, a Sephardic Jew. You don't get no more Jewish than Judah P. Benjamin. Judah P. Benjamin. You know? People don't understand. He was called the brains of the Confederacy. Literally, that was what he was called, the brains of the Confederacy. He was the one that put this stuff together. So when we're talking about the North and the South fighting, we're talking about largely Jews, in terms of economic interest in the South, wanting to maintain a slave system. And it's important for us to understand there are two different groups of Jews that come together. When we say Jews, we're talking about Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazi Jews. So many people are now, the information is going around about the Khazarians, but most people don't know a lot about the Sephardic. The Khazarians aren't the only bad guys. The ones who did the slave trade were the Sephardic. The Grandies, the Maranos, those ones that went into Catholicism, pretended like they got one now, AOC. I mean, she talks about it. My family pretended to be Catholic, but they were still Jews.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, AOC. And this is her. Like, this is not me being a conspiracy theorist. This is her saying, my family is a bunch of Jews who pretended to be Catholic. Yeah, those are the conversos. Oh, yeah. I'm sure you're teaching people about that. So you all, your audience knows about that. So
I've always suspected Nancy Pelosi in the same basket there. You know, I've never seen proof of it, but that's been my suspicion of her for a long time.
There are a lot of them, like the Rockefellers. According to Harrington's book, they're crypto Jews. I believe it because they operate exactly along the line that the Jews operate, but I can't prove that.
Yeah,
I agree with you. There are a lot of them out there that are like that. AOC has come out and just said it.
Wow. Yes. That's fascinating. If I could just jump in, you're making so many good points, Io, and I really am enjoying this conversation with you. You know, there's so many like facts about the slave trade that don't fit the narrative of what we're supposed to believe. Like some of the very first slaves that came to the United States were white, as indentured servants. There was black people that owned slaves. Black people in Africa, you know, would round up tribes they didn't like and sell them to the Arab slave traders, who sold them to the Jewish merchants who brought them to America on Jewish ships and sold them at Jewish markets. So the narrative really starts to fall apart that it's just one bad guy here, you know, and the whole thing too is that the Civil War, the slave trade was already falling apart because it's such a repugnant concept that you're going to sell anybody as a slave. Combined with the invention of the cotton gin, started to make slavery just not profitable anymore. So they had to make a new kind of slavery, which is what we're kind of in now. But it's just interesting how there's all these things about the narrative, if you really look into it, that don't fit what we're supposed to think. It's, you know, about slavery and the history of slavery.
And let me jump in there on the slavery. If we're talking about Western Hemisphere, well, first, let me go to one part first, and then I'll come back to that, to something you said that's important. I think the easiest way to look at it, and it puts it into perspective of what you're saying. You got two groups of Jews that come together to create the problem we see in the world today. The Ashkenazi, that they call the Khazarians, their primary thing is war and genocide. If you want to know who they are historically, they're a satanic. When I say satanic, I don't mean necessarily that they call it Satan, but their behavior is sexually vile and perverse, and they're murderous and they're brutal. The Russians have had problems with them for thousands of years. That's why they had to live beyond the pale for so long. Okay. You have that group. If you're looking at warfare and genocide, that's what they do. Then you have the Sephardic Jews. Slavery and economic exploitation is what they do. Again, right. Slavery is what they do. It's who they are. So when you put those groups together, what you have is a history of wherever they have been, whether it's Europe, of them enslaving whites, whether them in what they called white slavery, enslaving their own women, selling them for sexual. Yes. They are enslavers. This is what they do. When those two groups come together, you have a hodgepodge of slavery, oppression, economic exploitation, warfare, and genocide. That's who they are. As it relates to what ended slavery in the Western Hemisphere, the Haitian Revolution is the single most critical reality, because what happened is, in the first time in the history of the world, this has never occurred before, where a kidnapped and enslaved group of people in a foreign territory and land have organized, militarily defeated their oppressors and enslavers and kidnappers, and then declared themselves as an independent, autonomous state, sovereign state. It's never happened in the history of the world, but one time in Haiti. And what happened is, because the Haitians were threatening to invade the U.S., most people don't know, and this is just a piece of history. You know what? This, as a black person, of course, I get excited about this kind of history, but I'm going to skip past this part to keep it relevant to what the conversation we're having. So I'm going to go back to Judah P. Benjamin and talk about why I brought this up. Because this is the part that I think that really is the critical pieces for black people and white folks. We got to start talking without the Jew involved. We're not going to agree on everything. We have different histories, and it's been conflicting. But we got to start talking about those periods where the conflict was almost ended and what the Jew did to prevent it from ending. So let me talk about 1865. It's very important. We're talking about the Civil War. And I think a fair assessment that we could both agree on. From the white perspective of Lincoln, out of his own mouth, I want to preserve the Union. Lincoln was clear. If I could preserve the Union, he was talking to the group, if I could preserve the Union without freeing one slave, I would gladly do it. He said, unfortunately, gentlemen, I cannot. He said, I'm going to preserve this Union because we want a powerful, mighty nation. We can't do it with slavery as our base, because slaves can turn on you. That's not the system we want. Black people said, we want our people free. Lincoln said, I want you all to help me win this war, because they were losing the war to the South. And our people said, we'll help you. Emancipation Proclamation, we'll help you. No Emancipation Proclamation, we're going to go sit down, let you do it yourself. And so Lincoln said, I'll do it. Why? Because he wanted to make a mighty, powerful nation. He was a good mind. Here's what happened, and we don't talk about this. When he did that, Sherman, because the black soldiers fought so well in it, he really appreciated them in battle. Sherman said when the war was over, Sherman said, 40 acres and a mule. Black people, you going over here, South Carolina, off these islands. We're not using them that much anyway. It's your land. Your territory, you know how to work the land. We'll give you 40 acres and a mule. You can enjoy some American citizenship in your own space and time. You can get to enjoy some of this. We're going to go make our nation powerful. Johnson jumped in after the murder of Lincoln. Now, why was Lincoln murdered? Lincoln was murdered because at the same time he was trying to make a powerful nation, he was saying, I'm going to give you your greatest gift that I can give you, your own printing of your own money on the greenbacks. And I think Harrington Hitchcock, he breaks it down very well in The Synagogue of Satan. Get that book. It's an excellent book. He breaks it down for you. So now you have the bankers. On the one hand, you have the Jewish economic interests of the South in slavery. Then you have the Jewish economic interests of the North, which is we want America to have a central bank, because that's how we're going to take over America, economically breaking this nation. And so when Lincoln came out and said, we got the greenbacks, you're going to print your own money, the Jews said, no, Lincoln, it doesn't work that way. And they murdered him, but 2 weeks after the war was over. And so Andrew Johnson jumps in and removes the 40 acres and a mule. First place to start. It's very important to understand. That was the moment of time where literally we could have said, hey, it started bad, this relationship here. But guess what? We got our 40 acres in the mule. We have our own land. We're doing what we're doing here as American citizens. We're not integrating. We're not coming after your daughters. You're not coming after ours. We're two groups of people living in the same country, making a strong, powerful nation, building up, producing. But what happened? And I'm going to go to 18. I'm going to jump forward to 1876 and then go into 1877. In 1876, because this is what happened. It was a period called Reconstruction. And I'm breaking it down because I really want people to understand. Even though the racism that we face as black people still goes on today, one thing we never do is talk about the times when whites and blacks in this country have actually worked things out and it was working. We don't talk about it because it was short periods. Mm. We don't talk about why it was undone. So let's talk about it right now.
From
1865 to 1877 was a period called Reconstruction. I would argue that it's the only 12-year period of history in this country that we could argue where black people given a fair opportunity openly to operate as American citizens freely for the most part. And what I mean by that is the whites in the North, the one in the war said, we're going to send federal troops down because there's a lot of resentment from the South that black people are free now. We're going to allow black people to exercise American citizenship in their own region. They're not going to be, we don't about integration. They were in their own space. Let them do what they're going to do. What did we do? In 1 year, we eliminated, it went down to like 1% illiteracy rate. Having not been able to read for 250 years and now having a chance, people came down, many of the teachers, everybody learned to read. We built the city after city, town after town, all throughout the South. Because remember, for 250 years, we worked all day and night with no pay. Now we actually are free to work day and night and keep the land for ourselves. Or at the best price, because remember, black people controlled skilled labor during this time. We could do anything that needed to be done, plumbing, electric, whatever you needed. We had done it for free. Now we can charge and now we can make money and we can do for ourselves. We controlled skilled labor in this country. So we were doing fantastic, and with the support of the Northern troops to prevent anything from happening, we were fine. We had our own towns. We had our own senators and just everything in the states, in the regions that we were, mayors and everything. What happened? Two things happened. 1876, a Jew by the name of Gompers, Samuel Gompers, started the AFL, American Federation of Labor. For what purpose? This is the problem for the Jew. Now that black people are independent doing for themselves, now white Americans can look and see, wait a minute, we don't own anything. Who owns our infrastructure here? Who are the ones, the bankers that are pushing in to try to overthrow the environment? Who owns the big companies? Who's taking control of our companies, of our country? Now whites will be able to focus on that, which is why the Jew never wants independent black white autonomy, because we don't have to fight when everybody is comfortable. And now people begin to see what they're doing. So what did they do? They destroyed black people's ability to use what we had done for 250 years that made us put us in control of skilled labor as a tool to basically create unemployment for black people. There was no unemployment. Every man had a skill that he had learned. He taught his son, his grandson, and they used it to produce for themselves and had their own business. So everybody was okay until the Jews said, we create the AFL. Why was it a problem? Because when they created the AFL, there was one rule. You can't hire a black person. In order to get work done, if you're white in the South and you want to get, or really anywhere in the country, and you want to get plumbing done, you have to go through the union. But the catch is, black people aren't allowed to join the union. So hence, they literally take a people who don't need jobs because we're totally, we're not even looking for employment. We're self-sufficient now. We've done it for free. Now, even if we get a little bit, we did it for the lowest price and the best work because it's all we knew how to do. We took pride in it. We were part of the American construct for 12 years. Gompers comes in with the AFL. And now, literally, they're whites who got murdered in this country because they wanted the best plumbing job done. They knew that the black folk did the best job. They didn't listen to what the union said. They hired the black guy and the white folks. The Jews sent the white folks in there under the guise of racism. He's breaking the lines and killed white folks because they were supporting black people who were doing labor.
You know, this is fascinating. I wasn't aware of some of that. You know, I really like your spirit and your attitude. And like you said earlier, we don't have to agree on everything. You know, I think it's really important for people to have, like, man to man, you have to have respect for one another. That's the beginning of any relationship. You have to have mutual respect. And hey, if you disagree, no big deal. We put on our big boy pants and we deal with it, you know. I think you made some great points about Lincoln with the greenbacks. You know, that was probably what got him murdered for sure. But the problem I have with Lincoln is that he created the imperial presidency. He was a tyrant in many ways. And if you fast forward to today, Lincoln is what brought forth the tyrannical federal government in a lot of ways that we know now. But you are making good points about the greenback, and that was the big no-no. You cannot have independent currency. And of course, if you look at the War of 1812, well, gee, what happened in 1811? Well, the first charter of the Central Bank of North America expired. And lo and behold, the British tried to invade and attack America, and it was all because of the expiration of the first central bank. And central banking is sort of the Babylonian money magic that's used to control everything. Because if you can, I mean, the greatest power on this world, on this earth, if you're able to print money out of nothing and distribute it, you know, covertly in different ways, you can essentially do whatever you want. And that's what we're, the ultimate challenge we have right now is this fiat money system and you know, the complete disconnection from reality of our money system. But do you agree about what my points about Lincoln or?
I'm going to say this, it was interesting you're saying, because everything when you're dealing with Jews is conditional. I'll say what I mean by that. If we go back to Lincoln, this is what we have to remember. Basically, the deal was this. I mean, and I'm simplifying it. The deal was this. We want to preserve our union. We don't want the central bankers to overtake this country. That's obvious by the greenbacks. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things Lincoln said. It's in Harrington Hitchcock's book. He says, Lincoln said it. He was talking and he was saying, you know, I have two enemies. The Confederacy to my south and in my back are the bankers. And he said, that's my biggest issue is the bankers. He said, out of the two, the worst one are the bankers. The thing about the Lincoln situation, we have to remember, the question becomes, why is he so hard on being a Federalist? I'm going to say, when we consider the fact that the deal was, if we can work with the black people to end slavery, and with that agreement, fine, we'll end slavery. If we can keep the union preserved in this way, then we'll do it with the black people. But if that doesn't work and that's not sufficient to win, remember, Russia sent a fleet of ships. Russia. Now we got to ask ourselves, now, why is Russia supporting Lincoln in this whole endeavor? Because Alexander was very much of the mindset, we don't want the bankers here. America doesn't want the bankers. We're going to help America stay free, too. So if working and partnering with the blacks to beat the whites of the South, who are really being backed by the Jewish efforts to create the slavery, because, again, enslavement, that's the Sephardim. That's the Sephardic Jew that wants to enslave. And Europe has been fighting slavery just like Africa has been fighting slavery for centuries. And you never find a situation where the Jews are not intimately involved in the slave trade, no matter which group it is. Whether it's Arab slave trade, whether it's an African slave trade, whether it's European slave trade, the Jews are always involved. So the Russians are sending that to this side. Why do I bring up that point? If you're facing a situation where the Jews have the power of the states, in that moment, you want to create a strong federal government. So, for instance, for black people, why do we like the federal government? It's simple for us. It was the federal government that prevented Judah P. Benjamin, who financed, people don't know this, he is the one who financed the Ku Klux Klan. People talk about how evil the Klan is. Yeah, and of course, as a black person, I have this feeling of the Klan. But it wasn't until I found out that a Jew who had fled to England was the one who financed, through B'nai B'rith, the Klan didn't have the money to start. So I'm not even saying that I'm not pro Klan. I'm just saying they didn't even have the money to start the Klan. It was Judah B. Benjamin who financed it. Why? Because the power of the states at that time in the hand of the Jews was the tool that they were trying to use to keep slavery in. And it wasn't a matter of black people or whites being enslaved. It was a matter of which direction the country wanted to go, in my estimation. So in that sense, you want a strong federal government because you're trying to fight the Jews on that way. When the Jews take over your federal government like they've done now, and they can totally control your legislative, I mean, your executive branch. Well, then now you want a strong state independence month because you want whatever works to fight whatever the Jewish power is. But we don't talk Jew. So what we end up talking about is ideology as opposed to talking the reality of what we're facing. You have an executive branch now that is totally, like I've never seen anything like this. Totally, I call it Western Israel. This is not America. If you look at the executive branch now, I can, in the book, I got 3 pages. I was just intending to, I thought it would be 12 or 13 hard positions that they control. I couldn't believe it when I did the research. I couldn't believe it. I have 47 names, and those were, I literally stopped because I said, I don't want people to put the book down and get bored. The positions that they hold in the executive branch, they have totally overthrown the executive branch. So in today's world, anybody looking at the threat that we're facing, you now go against the federal government because you're not really going against the federal government. You're going against Jewish hegemony and total control. I'll move past there because I'm saying it to say, what happens with the Jews when you're fighting them? You have to be willing to adjust and make changes because when they change, if you try to do the same thing that you did before, you become confused. Like if you look at black people, we were totally Republican. You couldn't tell us not to be Republican. Why? Lincoln was Republican. Emancipation Proclamation was Republican. We were going to stay Republicans. The federal troops stayed in the South. Protectors, they were Republican. We were totally Republican. Once it changed and the Democrats were the ones we thought were working in our interests, that's where we went. It's a shift in things that happen. And it generally shifts based on where the Jews are at the time. So if I go back to that period, because this is where I really want to show how the Jews operate. Not only did they pull black people out of skilled labor, which accounts for why you see black men, you say, why are these thugs and gangs and all this? Because we were removed from employment by the AFL-CIO, which was created by Jews to import Jews. Remember, they did the Great Migration from Europe. Those were Jews. Nobody talks about this. They brought in Jews to take the jobs and the infrastructure that black people had, but they did something else. William Levy, a Jewish congressman from Louisiana, brokered the deal to remove the federal troops from the South and went to the halls of Congress in 1877 and delivered the speech that everybody talks about. It's the one remembered speech where essentially he says, no matter how well they fought, no matter how they feel, for black people in this country, as it was before the Civil War, so shall it be after the Civil War. They will not receive American citizenship in this country. And it was called the Great Compromise, Tilden Hayes. They gave Rutherford B. Hayes the presidency in agreement that he removed the federal troops. And that's when they put in the black codes. They stole all the land that we had built. They stole all the communities that we had built during Reconstruction. And literally that 12 years of American citizenship, where we actually were American citizens, we're doing very well, was completely eroded. They stole the land. They stole all of our items that we owned. They stole our homes. They murdered people. They raped. They pillaged. And it was all brokered by a Jew. Why do I bring that up? Because we missed some things in history. Man, we really had a chance. It didn't have to be like this. Ulysses S. Grant, he was the great general under Lincoln. Now, it was Grant that really, I really think, was the moment in history that white America missed it. And Lincoln, it was Lincoln's fault. Ulysses S. Grant, in defeating the South in the process of the war, became so disgusted by the carpetbagging Jews who were running to the South, buying cotton, funding the Confederacy to keep the war going and coming back and selling it at exorbitant prices so they were making profit off keeping the war going. He was so infuriated that he wrote what they call Order Number 11, where he expelled the Jews from the U.S. Treasury and said they have to be driven out of the South. He said, if they get on a train to go north, let them on happily with a smile. Prevent them from getting on anything coming south into the South. Like literally, it was an executive order. It was a warfare order, Order Number 11 from Ulysses S. Grant. I am convinced, based on his discernment and assessment of the problem, as he described them as the Hebrew, who have these usury practices, he said, who are keeping this war going and taking more lives that don't need to be taken. If Ulysses S. Grant would have had his way and Lincoln had not told him to undo that Order Number 11, I think he would have pushed the Jews out of this country. And had Grant done that, you would have literally had a situation where you had a small amount of black people in our own areas doing our own thing, predominantly white country. Both of us are doing production. And you don't have the Jew usury. You have productive people who are producing things. It will be a different country.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My only, I think, difference with you is I don't believe ultimately that the federal government is going to be our friend anytime soon. Because I think when you have the consolidation of power, just given human nature, just no matter what race it is, you're going to have problems when you give too much power in a centralized place. So I always think that decentralization is one of the keys going forward for us. Decentralization of power and going back to the communities and letting each community kind of decide, you know, what they want to do. And people can choose who they want to live around, who they want to associate with, and who they don't want to associate with. And, I just think that as long as, just because, let's say, you want to have a black community, it doesn't mean you hate white people. It doesn't mean that you can't respect or have friends that are white, I don't think, right? I mean, it's just a matter of giving people the individual freedom to form the lifestyle and community that they want to have for them and their people. What are your thoughts on that?
It's basic common decency and nature of life on this planet. I'm a black man. Yeah. I like black women. I want my children to be black and my grandchildren to be black and everybody else in the universe to come from me and my line to be black. And I like being around black. You're white. I think it's kind of strange if you don't feel the same way. Who wasn't made to like what they are? You know,
that's human nature, I think.
It's human nature. Everything. Look, the ant, the roach. I hate roaches, man. Let me tell you something. You want to bring some real anger out of me? Show me a Jew or a roach, either one. You know what I'm saying? But yeah. You show me a roach and I hate it. But here's the thing. I hate the roach. But he doesn't feel that way about himself. Everything wants to be what it is. What the Jews do is they make people hate what they are and want to form themselves into something that doesn't have a context, a history, a culture. So this is what they do. And it creates tremendous amounts of problems because we become confused, not realizing why they're doing it. They're doing it because they themselves are doing the exact opposite. They are Jews. They have value and they see the rest of us as not having value. And they're very definitive about believing in their way, their culture, their history and all of these things. They don't want any of the rest of us to do that. Now, what I would take, yeah. I would take a difference with you in terms of when you say decentralization only to this degree. As an African, we come from monarchs. Just quite frankly, the African history is monarchs. And there are benefits to both sides. I understand both angles. Even with monarchs, it's a largely from African monarch traditionally, not this stuff that we have now. I'm talking about traditionally. What you have is one ruler. If they're a good ruler, everybody's happy. Because what they do is they go to different regions and they just negotiate with everybody and keep things going. People are interdependent. They have their own communities, but the monarch can say, let's all do this so you can bring things together. It's a type of decentralization or it's a type of centralization, no matter how you look at it. What I look at is really, and I'm not just saying it because it's the topic. I'm dead serious with this. There are always issues in society. But the major issues in the modern context of the last 2,000 years comes with Jews, because what they bring is the destabilization of the infrastructure and the society. Their system of decentralization is different than what you and I are talking about. Their decentralization is making each group weak so they can come in like the fingers and break each one. Whereas if you have centralization, you have a fist. And now you can do something different with a fist than you can do with fingers. If we look at it from the perspective of that, what we'll find is that, quite frankly, in my estimation, the reason that we're talking here today, we're looking for a kind of centralization. What do I mean by that? You're white, probably more on the conservative end. I'm as far as you can get on the black end. If y'all find it in my history, you'd be like, who is this guy? How could he even be here? But this is the thing. Maturity has to set in, and humility. We need a centralization in recognizing there are only two groups right now if people are going to survive on this planet. It's the Jews and the rest of us.
Yeah. I think that's true. And we're at the top of the second hour, so hold on there. We'll bring it back for hour three. And I want to go into your book, talk more about your book. And I'd like to hit more upon this entertainment industry and really how it's been weaponized and used as a method to control everyone, essentially, and to mold our civilization. So stay tuned for hour number three. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to the third and final hour of Operation Scorpio. And we're going to continue our conversation with Io, author of the book, Jews Are the Problem. That gets right to the point, doesn't it? And Io, are you there, sir?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, great. You know, again, this has been a really good conversation so far, and I think it's important, you know, just because we may disagree about certain things, we're on the same page on enough things that I have a lot of respect for you, and I hope the feeling is mutual. And also, you know, writing a book is no easy task. I'm working on one, too, and to actually have it finished, edited, and published is quite an achievement. So maybe you could maybe go into your book a little bit here, and just let's touch upon that for a little bit. So I want to give you an opportunity to tell people about your book and what it's all about.
Okay. And let me tell you, this is going to probably sound for people, particularly for people who know, so that it's clear. So when I come here, I saw somebody make a comment. They say it's a little too black power stuff. Let me be clear. I think that's good that people are able to speak how they want to speak. And I think what we're doing here is something we never do. Look, like I said, I am the furthest fringe of black that you probably ever have talked to. I'm not in the category of anybody that you've seen on TV or any of that stuff there. I'm as black gets on the far end of the side. But going into this book, why did I write this book? It's going to sound bizarre, but it's very true when I say this. My life has been black and white. I've been in situations that groomed me for this around the Jewish community, but I didn't know what it was until, you know, I began to understand. Suffice it to say, it's like I'm looking at a history unfold, a deja vu. The extermination of the white race is occurring right before my eyes. And the reason I can identify it is because it's following the same pattern that was done to black people. So I'm actually watching you guys go through just quick anecdote. It was the Jews who put in place the whole crack cocaine epidemic, using Fox News and the various different whites as the apparent operators of it, but they were engineering it. I watched what crack did to devastate our families and communities, and so how the Sackler family and the Jews used the opioid crisis to destroy the white families. And it's the same tactic I'm watching them do. It's like, I'm like, I've seen this before. And it's the part that has me sit back and go, wait a minute. How long can I say white, 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 white before I realize that both white and black are on a string like a ping pong, and they smack one of us to go beat up on the other from their design, and then smack the other across the table and go beat up on the design before I say, wait a minute, I'm going to pull myself out and look at this objectively. Those towers that came down, that was them. Who wrote the Patriot Act, which again is their sick, perverted kind of humor. It's the very thing that removed any right from the Patriots. Who wrote that? Chertoff, Michael Chertoff. You have a Jew writing the Patriot Act to remove all the rights from the Patriots when they were involved in the entire process of making the thing that happened that led to this, which meant they set the whole thing up and have all of us confused about what's happening. I'm watching this as I'm watching what they've done to us happening to you all. And I said, you know what? When I pulled myself out, I said, it's no reason for us not to talk now. Because the very things that we talk about that we've been dealing with that whites have had a hard time hearing, you don't have a hard time hearing it now. When we say the police can be abusive and mistreat you, or they can steal an election from you. We had a sister in 2006 who was the first one that said, we have to get rid of Dr. Cynthia McKinney. She said, we have to get rid of these electronic voting booths because yes. they're stealing elections like they stole her election. Once they do it to us and it works, they roll it right over to you guys. She was the one that came out and told us. They asked her, as they were asking every congressional person, when you come in to sign an agreement that you will be in favor of Israel.
That's right.
From what I know, she was the only one that I know of that came out and said, my loyalty is to America. I'm not signing anything for me having a loyalty and support for any country on paper except America.
That's right. And then, that's right. They funded her opponents with some big money and probably stuffed the ballot boxes as well. You're absolutely right about her. I agree. Fascinating. Keep going.
Yeah. And then when we looked and say, well, who organized that? Might you wonder who it was that organized pushing her out of Congress? Obama's chief of staff. You remember his chief of staff?
Who also became
the mayor in Chicago?
Rahm Emanuel,
who is now what? The ambassador to Japan. So what we're seeing now, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, what we're seeing is Jews pushing everybody that would be in their way of the overthrow of the republic out of the way, whether they're white or black, usually doing things to black people first. And this is something I've learned. I didn't know this. They usually test things out on us, get them to work. Like I say, the crack cocaine, they see what these drugs do to a community. Then they just switch the drug and they do the same thing to whites. I didn't realize. I thought that it was the English that wanted to go into China that did the opium wars. Wasn't until I learned. No, it was the Sassoon family, a Jewish family from Iraq, or Iran, one of the two. And they were the ones that were doing the opium trade in there. And then they went and recruited England into that war. Meaning what? Meaning that the drug epidemics that are destroying families, this is not an accident. This is not something for money. This is a military assault on family structure that occurs around the world, and it's the same group of people doing it. And with the Sackler family getting caught for it, we're lucky now with the opioid crisis. You all at least did a great job of that. We now actually have them modern time being caught and found guilty of it. They're not going to pay no money for it, but nevertheless, we can see they intentionally doped up this country. So,
yeah,
I know we're supposed to be talking about the book, and I should remember to do that. let me do this because I think this is one of the pages in the book that I think, actually it's three pages, but I just want to read a little bit of it because I think it's going to really set the tone for why I wrote this book. What I realized is if we don't understand what's happening and who's doing it, no race is going to survive. Nobody's going to survive. That includes my people, your people, Asians. Nobody's going to make it. They're systematically at the same time attacking all of us, using us as proxies against one another.
And let's you and them fight, right?
But with our animosity to each other, even if it's for a good reason, they use that as a tool to prevent us from having this kind of dialogue. such that we can put that aside to say, here's a major problem called survival. And here's who's threatening all of our survival. Let us take action adequately and effectively to prevent it. Let me show you why it's so serious that I wrote this book now. I realize if folks who, quote, frankly, in America, y'all are the ones with the guns and the Second Amendment. They've taken the First Amendment from all of us. That's why we are struggling to find a way to talk to each other now. I'm glad we're doing it. But we got to fight to do this. It's not easy anymore. I want to show you who controls your executive branch. I'm not going to read all of them because it would be too much. But this is your current executive branch as of March 16, 2022. And I started with the vice president. Her husband is Doug Emhoff, Jew. Yep. Secretary of Treasury, Janet Yellen, Jew. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, Jew. Chief of Staff, Robert Klain, Jew. Deputy Director of CIA, David Cohen, Jew. Attorney General, Merrick Garland, Jew.
His real name is Garfinkel.
Yep.
It's not Garland. The family changed their name. I said that in the first hour. His real name is Garfinkel. So there you go. Yeah.
And what you just mentioned is one of the things that they have done traditionally. In order to remain anonymous or to hide, they changed their names. What they're doing now, you have the what's her name down there? She's running down in Georgia. She's running in Georgia. Now she's changing her religion. She's all of a sudden magically found Jesus. What's her name? Loomer. Are y'all familiar with Loomer? She's Jewish. Very Jewish. I mean, like, she's Jewish posing in a picture with the guy, the gay guy, Milo, when he had blood all over him in the tub, some satanic ritual thing. She's posing in the picture, Jew. Now she's magically found the blood of Jesus. And now she's going to the Christian right, asking them to vote for her in Georgia for political office. And I'm looking, I know this is past we were just talking about conversos of AOC. At least they hide it. She's not even hiding it. Hey, I'm a Jew, but now I'm Christian now. Do you accept me? Will you vote for me? I mean, this is literally happening in real time. Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas.
Yep.
Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, Jew. Deputy Secretary of State, Wendy Sherman, Jew. Undersecretary of State Political Affairs, Victoria Nuland, the one who did the overthrow of 2014 of Ukraine.
Yeah.
Victoria Nuland. Director of Office of Science and Technology, Eric Lander, Jew. At the time.
And just by the way, Nuland's real name is Noodleman. Again, a name change there. And she's married to Robert Kagan of PNAC, you know, the great, we need a new Pearl Harbor. And sure enough, we got one, didn't we?
I mean, we can't make this stuff up. We can't make this stuff up. That's why I did the book. I said, we can talk about it, but what happens when a person actually looks at it? Counselor to the president and the COVID-19 response coordinator at the time, it was Jeffrey Zients. Always trust the Zients. Never trust the Zients. I don't trust the Zients. Assistant Health Secretary Rachel Levine. That's the transsexual. You got the
And his real name is Dick Levine. So no irony there, right?
Here you got a transsexual that doesn't know he's supposed to be a man and wants to be a woman at a high ranking position in Health and Human Services.
Yeah, sick. Really sick.
Administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, Cass Sustine. Administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, the wife of Cass Sustine, Samantha Power, two Jews. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, Dana Strau. Director of the Centers of Disease Control, Rochelle Walensky. So you got Walensky and always trust the Zients, never trust the Zients. You have both of them in control of the gateway to the apocalypse, this death jab, the Jew shot, and they're Jews. And it's the American public they're on. Now, and I'll say this as an anecdote. in Washington, D.C., they passed in 2020, they passed it. And now they just redid it because we had a brother who actually sued them and won. But they passed the minor consent for vaccination. In short, if you're 11 years old or older, you can consent on your own without your parents' knowledge to getting a so-called vaccine that's not a vaccine. We're talking about open genocide against children. Children are getting myocarditis and pericarditis. That's not disputable at this point. And again, going back to what we talked about earlier, the way they like to do things. And this is why, again, why we write the book. People really got to understand. They know that people are going to feel some kind of way when children start getting strokes and aneurysms and heart failure. Do you remember? It was only like last year when they started doing these campaigns saying children can have strokes, too.
Yeah, yeah. They're trying to normalize it. It's always been that way. Children have always had heart attacks. And yeah, it's incredible the mind control here. Yeah, absolutely.
So they're normalizing it. And we see again, we see who's in control of it. And we're not just saying they're in control of it. We have it listed here. Deputy National Secretary Advisor for Cybersecurity, Ann Neuberger. Director of Technology and National Security Council, Shannon Wiseman, Jew. Polly Trottenberg, Deputy Secretary of Transportation, Jew. Jessica Rosenworcel, Chairman of Federal Communications Committee, FCC. So, Jim Klein, co-chair of the Gender Policy Council. So who's in control of determining what gender is, which is just two genders, male and female. And then the Jews are trying to change that and push this drag queen story hour in our schools and stuff like that. We're not making any of this stuff up. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I think you want to say something.
Yeah, no. There are only two genders, like it or not. That's how we were created. And of course, this is all part of this effort to break apart basic morality and the family and transform people into slaves. All of us. They want everyone to become a slave, going back to our earlier conversation. And if you look at the Talmud says that, you know, a Jew is supposed to have something like 1500 slaves, and all the goyim cattle will be there to serve them. That's really what they believe at the highest levels. And of course, that's satanic. It doesn't mean that every Jew walking the streets understands this or believes it. And then, you know, you're reading all these people involved in the administration and the CDC. You look at Albert Bourla, you know, another Jew, a Greek Jew. And they of course, yeah.
Sephardic and then Jew that runs Pfizer.
Exactly. And I've actually seen footage of Jews bragging that, hey, we created this wonderful vaccine. They love to give themselves awards too. They gave Bourla some wonderful award, you know. And so, yeah, that chain goes upwards. And then you look at the banking and Hollywood, and you know, it goes on and on. So keep going. This is great. I mean, how do you argue with this? I guess that's my question. How do you argue with what you're saying, other than say, well, you're bad, you're an anti-Semite, and you're a bad person? That's about all you can say.
That's right. So, and I agree with you. And when we're talking about, you know, why I wrote the book, what I realize is it's great for you to have this information. It's great that I have this information. But how do we ever meet each other? Again, I'll be perfectly honest. If and when you run across anything I've done in the past, you'll say, I don't want anything to do with this black. Look at how he talks. When I saw it as black and white, I'm black 100%. But what happens is with a book like this, now it's not about my emotions or your emotions. When I come to a book and say, look, the head of Johnson & Johnson, Alex Gorsky, a Jew. The head of AstraZeneca, Leif Johansson, Jew. The head of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, Jew. The head of Moderna, Stefan Bancel, Jew. The head of Sputnik, even in Russia, Ginkberg, a Jew. And then we look and see Tal Zaks when he did he came right on the when he was the chief medical operator for Moderna. He talked about this is technology that can edit our genes and put in whatever line of code they want and take out whatever they want. So we have these Jews that are bragging, like he said, about the fact that they now control. Really, they're talking about controlling the genome, which becomes the person. And so, yeah. You know, how do we not have this kind of discussion? That's why I did the book. How do whites, you know, I want to make this point because I saw somebody say something in the thread, and I think we got to watch this because, again, it's another Jew trick. They made some very tricky things. You said something, and I want to lateral it to race. We should not be debating male and female being the two genders. We should be classifying anybody that doesn't understand that is either unequipped to have a discussion of morality or ethics, or they're a psychopath.
Yeah, or mentally ill. Yeah.
You're mentally ill or a psychopath, right? Maybe you're mentally ill, bordering on psychopath, yeah. Because how mentally ill are you that you don't know what a male or female is? But I bridge that over to the race thing. I think that we have it wrong. I don't think we've been doing this right. We say race doesn't matter. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. One of the strongest, two of the strongest things that people can organize based off of. One, religion. Religion is a powerful thing. You believe in a God concept and you're standing next to somebody with religion, you can really organize on something because the belief in is based or should be based in morality. And morality is a strong tie to hold together. Blood, it may be even a stronger tie. So what happens with the Jew is the Jew is the one who sings the song that race doesn't matter. We shouldn't be talking about race. That's not how we should be talking. Why am I, as a definitive black person, who everything in the world for me is blackness, why am I talking to whites now? Because I realize that the Jews are trying to exterminate both of us. I want to save my race. They're exterminating your race, which means at this point, if they're exterminating my race and your race, whatever I agree or disagree with you on, we should be able to talk if you're sensible enough to see that it's actually happening, that I'm not making it up. I'm not coming to you trying to find a friend when I say they're exterminating the white race and I can see it. I've never looked at it because I'm looking out to save my own race. I never looked at it. When I used to hear whites talking about they're killing us in our population, I thought you guys were just complaining because I saw what was happening to us. When I stepped back and removed myself from the emotion of it and my own personal sense of my interaction with whites over, whatever. What's the truth of it? What they're saying is true. The Jews are bringing in Hispanics from the bottom, 100,000 Ukrainians who they've trained, who are Bolsheviks. If you know anything about the Bolshevik Revolution, if you don't watch Europa, we put the QR code in the book so you can go watch it. This is for white folks. If you don't know what they did to the Russians and then to the Germans, if you don't understand what they did to the Russians, and listen, as a black person who's had a hard experience with white folks, I've never felt this way watching something about white folks talk about what's happened to them. I'm going to be honest with you. When I watched Europa and what these Bolsheviks did to the Russian people, I found a newfound appreciation for Russians. I'm going to be honest with you. I always knew that what said about what happened in Germany was true because about the Balfour Declaration. But they make it hard. When I watch Europa, it makes it hard not to see some aspect. Again, I'm still black. I'm not a pro-Nazi. But on some level, when you see the kind of perversion that they promoted in Germany and how Hitler in 6 years turned that around, I mean, on some level, if you don't say it publicly loud, you have to appreciate his ability to do such a thing. I mean, what he was dealing with, when you deal with these Jews and they overthrow your republic, you end up with drag queen story hour. You end up with them taking your children off into the wild blue yonder to do whatever you, God knows what to them. You end up with inoculations and murder and starvation. You have to fight back. You don't have an option. So I'm saying that to say we have to be careful not to take the Jew narrative. If you're white and you're proud about it, long as it doesn't affect me negatively and my people, why would I want you to be white? I'm black. I want to stay black. Why wouldn't we want that? And if we want that, then now we have to say, well, what is the threat to that? And each time we do that, what we'll come up with, it's the Jew. So then if it's the Jew, then why can't we say, I'm black and I'm proud? And you say, well, I'm white and I feel good about it. And I want my children to be that way. You should. I want my children to be black. Okay. Now, what are we going to do about these people that don't want either one of us to have that? They would prefer us to go integrate and misogynate and produce something that no longer has a race to hold on to, no longer has a definitive history and culture to be proud of. no longer has that thing to say, we're the best on the planet. No, we're the best on the planet. Okay, as long as it doesn't cause us to have to go and destroy one another. I think that we should have the racial pride because it becomes the thing that we actually come together with and don't have to, we don't have to be integrated in the sense of social integration where I'm going after your daughter or you're coming after mine. That's where the tension with men comes in. Men protect their women and children. We're supposed to have that. That's what a male of any species does. But if we can respect that, then this is one of the things that the Klan said about Marcus Mosiah Garvey. Because most people don't know, Marcus Mosiah Garvey was our greatest leader, in my estimation. I mean, just the magnitude of what he was able to accomplish. At least one of our greatest leaders. I would say he was maybe arguably the greatest, but he had a great relationship with the Klan. Now, what was that great relationship? They weren't friends, but what he said was, as opposed to the Jews, he said the liberals, but he was talking about Jews, because when he started naming them, Murray White Obenton and Spingarn, Joel Spingarn, he's talking about the Jews, Julian Mack, who was the judge on his trial, Jews. He said, the difference is the Klan speaks and says what they mean. I know what they intend, and they know what I intend. We're honest with one another. That is better to deal with him than the one who smiles in your face and stabs you behind the back. And even when he was deported from the country, the Klan would write back and forth with him. Why? Because the Klan would say, listen, we may not be pro-black, but we like a black man who is, because at least he loves his own people and doesn't want to come over here and mesh with mine. We can respect one another. And when we do that, we can actually see where the real problem is. And I think that's the world we're in right now.
Yeah, I think, you know, mutual respect is important, especially man to man. If you don't have that as a starting point, you're going to end up with problems. And, I kind of look at everyone I meet individually and judge them on how they behave, what they know, what they say, and what they do. And I think it's a complicated issue. I think you're bringing up some interesting points. And, you know, and about World War II, this is one of the biggest lies ever sold to the world, really. And it's not to say that, you know, Hitler was this, you know, living saint, but essentially what it comes down to is Weimar Republic. There's so many parallels to what is happening now, the degeneracy, the usury, the inflation, where, you know, it's all a pattern. But if you look at what actually happened, America ended up defending communism in World War II. I mean, you could say the Nazis were a threat. Well, maybe so. I don't, you know, really believe that so much. But the bigger threat was certainly communism. Yet we did all we could to keep that regime propped up. The Jews funded communism in Russia. We used the Lend-Lease Act to keep it going. And even after the war, you know, we tried to keep communism going there as long as possible. So the whole World War II narrative is just completely fallacious, and it wasn't really a world war. It was mostly a European war.
And let me say from my perspective looking in, because what I was able to see, and again, I put this in the book, this is a very group dealing with, and we use terms like communism, but honestly, I try not to use those terms. It's really Jewish hegemony. It's like Jewish domination and control. All of it is Jewish control and Zionism. Because we call it communism, but really what we're talking about is Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks were what? It was a bunch of Jews. We're talking about Yagoda. We're talking about Kaganovich. We're talking about Lenin and Marx.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all Jews. I mean, the ones that were of note and of relevance. Oh, yeah. And then we see Schiff was the one over here financing them. So, and then they murdered the Tsar. So, I mean, you're murdering leaders of sovereign nations. This is the interesting thing that they were able to do and why I think it's so important for us to be able to have dialogues like this. And I go over it in the book. Jews are the problem. You can go to jewsaretheproblem.com and you can purchase it right there. Jewsaretheproblem.com. Here's the thing.
Okay.
This is the magic of what they were able to do. We talked about entertainment being what was created to keep black people enslaved. I want to tell a story, but then I'm gonna roll this right into what we're talking about internationally. There was a guy who was the Jeffrey Epstein of his time. His name was Leo Frank. Long story short, he was a rapist and a murderer of a 13-year-old little girl in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
black people were so upset, we started making songs about it. Like, how could you do something like this? Who rapes and murders a 13-year-old little girl? Long story short, the whites were infuriated. They actually, and it was unheard of at the time, they actually did a black man who saw what happened testify against Leo Frank and help get him convicted and gave him the death penalty. The Jews fought right. and talked the person out of it. And the white folks organized, went to the jail, got him, took him, and lynched him. He should have got lynched.
Yep.
You rape and murder a child, you should get lynched. You need to dig him up and lynch him again. As far as I'm concerned, you can't do that stuff, man. Here's what's interesting, though. In that he became the face of rape and murder of white children in the early 90s, 1913, same year the Federal Reserve Act happened. They steal your economy. They steal your economy through the Federal Reserve. They made a movie over the next 2 years called Birth of a Nation. And this is the science of entertainment, how we got to start understanding what's happening. Whites were infuriated. The whole country was talking about Leo Frank over those 2 years. The face of rape and murder of children is a Jewish face. Jews are becoming known as rapists and murderers because of the Leo Frank becoming getting convicted. The ADL was formed. Yep. I want you to hear me. The Anti-Defamation League was formed essentially because a Jew who raped a white woman and blamed a black man doesn't have the same rights that a white man that blames a black guy gets. In other words, why is it if I say that a black man committed the crime I commit, you're going to find me guilty, but nobody else? We shouldn't be defamed that way. So that's the birth of the ADL, to defend a rapist and pedophile. They made the movie Birth of a Nation, and what they did, remember, this is when movies are really first starting. It's in the theater. It's the first blockbuster in the history of this country. Again, entertainment being used to enslave black people. They take a female who looks just like Mary Fagan, who they've been putting in the paper all around the country. In the movie, she gets attacked by a black man, but it's really a white guy with black face. Again, the black face character that the Jews do. MGM takes that film and spreads it around America and does what? Replaces the psychology of Leo Frank, the Jeffrey Epstein Jewish rapist and murderer of the little white child, in the film as a black man and black people doing this. And what happens and what follows is from that point, 1915 to 1960s, whites are concerned that black men are going to rape white women. And now we go through a period of lynching. This is what we don't understand. And it means a lot to me because I'm black. At first, I just thought y'all were just absolutely evil. And I'm not saying it wasn't evil. I just want to be honest about it. When I saw the science of what they did, I said, wow, they can take this thing, take how you already feel. You're against a rapist and he was Jewish and you did the right thing. You hung him. Then they do the movie and make the person black and you don't know what they're doing. They didn't tell you that we're changing it in your mind. They take that emotion, put it on our people. And now when you see a black man, you're ready to lynch him for anything. And we actually got lynched and communities burned because of that. And it was by Jews. Why do I bring this up? Because that is the assault they're making against black people in the West. While in the East, they're murdering the Tsar. They're going in World War I. The same Jews who were put out of Russia after the murder of the Tsar, the only country that would accept them was Germany. Germany lets them in, and they do what? What they always do. They find an opportunity after World War I, when the Germans had already won World War I. It wasn't a world war. Like you said, it was a typical European war. Germany had won it. Their navy surprised everybody. The war was over. The Jews of Germany, who were let in because of what they did in the murder of the Tsar in Russia, the only country we're taking was Germany. They go make a backdoor deal with the Rothschild in England saying, look, we want Palestine as our homeland. If you give us that, we'll make you win the war. They're like, we can't win the war. Germany's too powerful. We'll bring the U.S. in. Don't worry about it. They come to the U.S., run into stores, start taking any German product and taking it and throwing it out the window, throwing bricks through windows, the same Antifa type of stuff you see here, or the gay lesbian movement that people call Black Lives Matter. There's nothing black about that. That's a Jewish organization that has nothing to do with black people. Again, we have the information in here to show you that. There's some of us that know that. The same thing they did then, that same behavior is what they're doing now with that. Just get some people out there being rowdy in the streets. They went and did that in America then and made America all of a sudden see the Germans as the enemies and bad guys. America jumps into World War One. So what we're looking at is a war declared by the Jews against Germany. So when World War II happens, World War II, not even Hitler's rise, the rise of Hitler was in response to the war that the Jews openly declared against the Germans. Now, I'm not pro-German. I'm just telling the history as it occurred.
And Io, you're making some great points. You know, first of all, this goes back to this whole concept, let's you and them fight. You've got the Leo Frank situation. Then they, like you said, they put a black guy in as the villain in the movie. That's very fascinating. That's a really good point. And then you fast forward to today, you look at the ADL, which is the offspring of this whole thing. You've got this Jonathan Greenblatt character who it's a dead ringer for Nosferatu. I mean, he really does look like Nosferatu, the original vampire. And the organization has essentially been used as a method to control free speech now. They just want to, everything's hate speech now, you know, and there's no such thing as hate speech. Like, you might say something that I don't agree with or vice versa, but it doesn't make it hate speech. It doesn't mean I have the right to make you stop saying what you want to say. And vice versa. Again, it comes down to respect between men and also some kind of spiritual integrity, some kind of inherent moral code that you live by that extends to everybody you deal with as long as they're in the same level of behavior. So you're making some great points.
Let me talk You're talking about free speech. This is where, I mean, it's everything that we're talking about is relevant. It's happening right now as we're tweaking. When you talk about free speech, people need to watch Europa. You can go to bitchute.com. You got to watch this. It's a 10-part series, or you can watch it in one, but I suggest you watching the 10-part, part 1, 2 through 10. Europa. It really talks about what we're talking about. Do you know that right now as we speak, well, first of all, do you know that during that time, when the Jews took over Russia, the Bolsheviks, do you know that they made it illegal what they called anti-Semitism?
Mm-hmm.
And if you did it, the penalty was death. Like, literally, not no death, like no trial and all this stuff. Like, they take you out, they hang you, or they cut your head off. I mean, these are some very violent people. Would you know that as you and I are speaking right now, I'm going to just bring this up to the public so people know they're doing the exact same formula. This is not a different formula. Right now, they have something called the IHRA. And there's an article just so people can look at it. If you want to look it up, it says activists block adoption of IHRA definition of anti-Semitism by Maryland County. And in short, what happened, and the IHRA stands for International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. What they've done is that they reshaped the definition of anti-Semitism and getting, they got the, in Virginia, it passed. In Maryland, we were fortunate. I'm here in Maryland. We were fortunate that there's a Palestinian group that alerted people and stopped it. They're redefining anti-Semitism that basically says anybody that says anything about Zionism or Israel is anti-Semitic. Why is that a problem? I can just tell you where it's going. We've seen it through the Bolshevik Revolution. What's the direction? What they're doing now, because people are catching on to them, they know what the natural inclination is when you find out that they're exterminating you. People are not going to take that well. So they want to make it illegal to do that. So they start by creating the term and redefining the term, like they redefine virus. What's next? Next is going to be, if you want to do a government contract, if you're on this list of IHRA, oh, you're anti-Semite, you can't give government money. Then what's next after that? You want to apply for a job. Or you can't get this job because you're on the IHRA list. Oh, you want to apply for concealed carry. Oh, you want a concealed carry permit. Oh, you can't get that. Or we have to take your permit and take your weapon because you're anti-Semitic. You're listed on the IHRA. In other words, what we're doing here as we speak, it passed in Arlington, Virginia. This is right here in Washington, D.C. I mean, right in the surrounding area. It didn't pass in Maryland because the Palestinians brought it to people's attention. But this is worse than what they're doing with the BDS movement. I mean, like you saying, in terms of censorship, they're literally making it illegal for us to have the discussion we're having here now this truth that we're putting on the table, that's in the form of a book that you can read. I did not make those people have the names that they have, that have been appointed and not elected by the American Republic, who are now in the executive branch of the U.S. government. I didn't do that. I didn't make their names Jewish. I didn't make their parents Jewish. That's who they are. Sharing that information is not, it shouldn't be illegal if we live in America. But if we're in Western Israel,
oh yeah,
under the Bolshevik assault, then it becomes illegal. This is real talk we have.
Oh, sure. And of course, the you know, the holy historical event known as the Holocaust, that's what actually gets people put in jail. Even though if you look into it, it just doesn't hold water. There's so many, you know, holes in the story. It's not even funny. But again, people are actually getting thrown in jail for that. And that's why I'm so against any idea of free speech or hate speech, because you start going down that road and that's the end result. People get thrown in jail for questioning historical events. And it's really, they're the ones that want to hinder free speech. You may say something I don't like, I can handle it, and vice versa. I'm not easily offended. I like to let people speak their mind, especially if they're informed and have information to share, not just spewing off, you know, just emotional nonsense, not based on fact. So this is really an interesting conversation, Ion. I really actually am enjoying it. But let me ask you your thoughts on this too. How do you see Freemasonry fitting into this? And then you've got the, you know, you've got Prince Hall Freemasonry for blacks, and the Boule Society, and that, you know, and it's, I've heard Freemasonry described as Judaism for Gentiles. So what's your thought on how that fits into this picture of control and manipulation and secret societies?
Okay, I'll say it like this. On the one hand, on just on a basic level, there are many good people who are part of these societies that aren't involved in any nefarious stuff. So let me just be clear.
Yes.
There are plenty of good people who are just part of these groups for brotherhood. But, and it's, again, it's something that I do in the book, and I want to really bring it because it's an excellent point, but it's in the book. When I want to know what something is, I go to the source. The source, the protocols to the learned elders of Zion. The Jews said what it is. They said all secret societies will be under our control. It is a tool for the goyim to believe that they have something so that we can give them a place that they believe is a high place of some priority, so that we can then use them to do the things that we want to have done. So what I would say is they said this as early as 1905, when it really began to get spread throughout the country, the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. They stated very clearly, Freemasonry is a tool of ours to falsely give the Gentiles or the Goyim or the Schwarzes or whoever, whatever term they want to use, to give us something we think, believe something that makes us powerful. But here's the reality. How much power did any Freemasonry have to stop Donald Trump from having the election stolen from him? None. Because the people with the power are the Jews. And so they give different people things that make them feel powerful. So you have people who are part of entertainment. And they're making all these funny signs and these pyramids. What kind of power do they have but to do whatever the Jews tell them to do? And when they don't, they take it all back, like Whoopi Goldberg. They smack him on the hand and say, stay in your lane, little boy. Stay in your lane, little girl. You do as you're told.
Yeah.
It's a tool to make people feel good, getting a few coins here, a few shekels. It has no power in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. Although I do think at the highest level it's nefarious, but you've got the lower level people, and it is a brotherhood and it's a social gathering kind of thing. But yeah, it's a good idea of hierarchical levels, where you have people at the high levels that actually know that, you know, they're actually worshiping Lucifer. It states that in Albert Pike's book, Morals and Dogma. But back in the day, to get a copy of that book, you had to be, you know, a 32nd degree Mason. So, but now you can buy a copy of it on the internet, you know, so the secret's getting out. But, and I think it's a good point that these secret societies are controlled, from a central source, and they're made to make people feel important. That's a very, very good point. And of course, you know, the protocols were deemed to be a forgery, and a forgery is a copy of something real. So they never said that the protocols are made up out of whole cloth. They're saying that was a forgery, and it's like forging a great work of art. You copy it exactly so it looks like the original one. So that was never said that those protocols don't exist. I'm just saying that the copy that was put forth was a forgery. So the definition of words is very important.
This is what I did with the book. To remove any dispute or doubt about the protocols to learn Elders of Zion, instead of doing it that way, what I did is I took some of them, not all of them, and I talked about what they said. I put that part of the protocol there. Then I talk about what's happening right here in front of our face right now. Then I put the discussion and relate it right there to the protocol. And what people will see as they read it, it is almost impossible to believe that they wrote the things that are happening right now in front of our face in something that was listed 100 years ago, and point by point with things that are happening to us right here in our life every day that we see, they're doing exactly those things. Once you do it in this type of format, there's no more disputing anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're so right. And if you read them with an objective mind, whoever wrote those either was a damn good novelist, or they knew the plan, because it's really being, you know, followed almost to the letter. It's actually incredible. And the kind of mind it would take to even think of those things, most people don't even think that way. And that's part of the reason why it's so unbelievable to so many people, because it's so diabolical, the thinking within it. Most people simply don't have that kind of mind.
Most people don't. Here's, it's a bad thing, but I think maybe it benefits us in this moment. What they're doing now, they're not hiding anymore. They actually have drag queens, and they're taking children to drag queen story hour. So the perversion in the Babylonian Talmud, which we talked about again in the book, which we show you so that we give you a resource you can go see for yourself, that the Babylonian Talmud promotes pedophilia among the Jews. This is their premier Bible. This is their premier, if you want to call it, religious reference source. It's not a debate.
Oh, yeah.
So what happens is, once we have access to this, it's one thing to read that or that say believe it. It's another thing when you look out and see drag. It's another thing when you see that California is passing laws that give license to pedophilia. And then you look at who put the law out, and his name is Wiener, and he's a Jew. It's like, at some point, we run out of options to deny the truth. They're not hiding anymore.
That's true. And, you know, I think the ultimate goal of all of this, first we had gay rights, now we have trans rights, and then the coming thing is pedo rights. That is the end game in all this, and they already have it all set. Hey, if you don't like it, you're a hater. You know, you have some kind of hang up, man, about we just love children. You have a hang up. That's where this is all going, and it's only a matter of time. They're starting to slowly bring it out, but that has always been the end goal with all of this.
Yeah, you know, interestingly enough, what people know me for from the 1990s till now is I was always lecturing against homosexuality and the birth, and that really it was never homosexuality. We call it homophilia. It's all about pedophilia. That's what the whole goal has been from the beginning. I've been talking about this since the 90s. It's just now you don't have to convince people as much. But I want to, because I know our time is winding down, I want to end on this point because it ties all of it together. And this is why I wrote the book. And this is why we're having this conversation today. And I hope we can have more conversations. And I appreciate everybody here that's listened and tuned in. I'm going to tell you a story. This happened to me. I went to something called Reawaken America. His name is Clay Clark. They're having these around the country. I said, let me go see what these white conservatives are talking about. And something happened to me there that really told me, I was like, wow, the Jew is really good at what they do. Whenever I hear whites talk about these leaders of these countries that are violent, tyrannical leaders, one of the ones that almost always comes out is Robert Mugabe. And I just want to drop this and leave this with everybody, because I want y'all to hear this. And it's going to really, I hope it sets in so you can understand what I'm saying here. It's a very interesting thing. when I was at that conference, I was so, it's weird. It was mostly white. I was probably a few black people there. Not one time did I hear anybody opine or be cowardly about being against homosexuality. They were 100% against it. And I felt so at home in that reason, in that perspective. I was like, finally a place where nobody's apologizing and, you know, backing up and backpedaling before they say, look, we don't agree with this. It's unhealthy behavior. It's ungodly. And we're against it. I was like, I love that spirit. But something happened that really like shook me. I said, this is strange. My perspective, I know what happened in Zimbabwe. This is what I do. I always thought that whites are just racist and you all are calling Robert Mugabe a tyrant because you're on board with what's happening and everything that happened in Zimbabwe. I'm thinking that you all know what happened. When I was in there, somebody was on the stage and they were talking about something and they were white. And they said, and the black people in Africa are sick of people coming and stealing their diamonds and stealing their gold. And all the white folks, and I study people. It wasn't like they were just placating her. They were clapping and they were like really feeling. And I was like, it was weird to me because I was like, my mindset is, no, y'all want us to be oppressed. Y'all know what's happening. And they were just as glad to hear her say that black people are sick of this stuff and they don't want to take the jab. And I listened and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I said, the reason that they don't like Robert Mugabe is not because they're on board with what's happening. They have no idea what happened. So let me tell you what happened with Robert Mugabe. And I'm sure I know y'all don't know because most of my people don't know. Robert Mugabe was probably one of the single most loved leaders in Africa. Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa. Mm-hmm. Europe loved him. We didn't know at the time. He didn't know at the time. He just knew he wouldn't do it. But they were trying to push the homosexual agenda. Nobody knew that. They didn't announce this. So they came to his country and they had a book fair and they tried to do some lesbian stuff, sell it at the book fair to kind of ease the way in. He went bananas. He said homosexuals are worse than dogs and pigs because at least dogs and pigs know a man's supposed to be with a woman. He said, this is not our culture. This is not African. We're not going to do this. No way. We don't care what you do. He didn't know what that was going to do. He didn't know it was a full agenda. When he did that overnight, Europe turned on him. And then they had a thing called a Lancaster Agreement where they had already agreed if he wants to buy his land back from people who had stolen it. But if he wants to buy it back, he'll buy it market value. His people started saying, we want some of our land. He went to buy it back and they said, no, we're not going to sell it. He said, we have an agreement. No, we're not going to sell it because the war was launched because he said no to homosexuality. They had already penetrated South Africa. And now they were trying to come up through Zimbabwe and spread it throughout Africa. And Robert Mugabe blocked it. Since he blocked the homosexual agenda, they waged complete war on his country. So everything you see happening in America from people always say the inflation because of Mugabe. Mugabe was there before the inflation. Mugabe said no to homosexuality. That's when the inflation came. That's when the tyranny came. The entire narrative of Robert Mugabe being this tyrant and this monster was predicated on the fact that he blocked the homosexual agenda without even knowing that's what he was doing. He was just like, I'm not doing it. And he becomes known as this tyrant. And the message is spread through the media to the whole world. And that's how people feel. But I want you to understand, because I just want us to understand the dynamic. Because I didn't know that was the case, I'm thinking that you all are in favor of homosexuality and you want to make Africa gay. So when I go out, I say, look at these Europeans pushing this homosexuality on black people. It's true, but I got to know which Europeans it is. I didn't notice at the time.
Right.
I would have thought you were just a gay dude pretending to be heterosexual who wanted black people in Africa to be gay. Or even if you were straight, I would have thought that you were in favor of that notion. The Jews are very good. They give a false narrative. We don't know another narrative. All of us repeat the narrative. And unless we go in and find out a different narrative, we can't even share a different narrative. And once we try to share it, they block us.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that just to say, a lot of what I've found out is that the leaders that they're most hostile towards, either in the beginning were good or made a change for the better. And then we get a false narrative. And that false narrative is coming from the Jews because it's someone who's not on board with their goals and objectives.
Yeah, there's certain agenda points that always move forward, and that's one of them. And I just want to thank you for coming on the show, Io. I found you to be very intelligent and informed, and you have a good spirit, man, and I really appreciate talking to you. And I think you're going to be coming on the Perfect Triangle here a little later. It's scheduled for that, and I'd like to have you come on the show again some other time too. So very nice to meet you, and I appreciate your perspectives, man.
All right, you too. Appreciate it.
Okay. All right, you take care, and everyone stay tuned for tomorrow. We're going to have the Sane Asylum, and Giuseppe will be with us. Bye-bye.